Chapter 4. Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar had set up their home in the cellar of a Victorian hospital closed down 10 years earlier because of National Health Service budget cutbacks. The property developers, who had announced their intention of turning the hospital into an unparalleled block of unique luxury living accommodations, had faded away as soon as the hospital had been closed, and so it stood there, year after year, grey and empty and unwanted, its windows boarded up, its doors padlocked shut. The roof was rotten, and rain dripped through the empty hospital's interior, spreading damp and decay through the building. The hospital was ranged around a central well, which let in a certain amount of grey and unfriendly light. The basement world, beneath the empty hospital wards, comprised more than 100 tiny rooms, some of them empty, others containing abandoned hospital supplies. One room contained a squat, giant metal furnace, while the next room housed the blocked and waterless toilets and showers. Most of the basement floors were covered with a thin layer of oily rainwater, which reflected the darkness and the decay back toward the rotting ceilings. If you were to walk down the hospital steps, as far down as you could go, through the abandoned shower rooms, past the staff toilets, past a room filled with broken glass, where the ceiling had collapsed entirely, leaving it open to the stairwell above, you would reach a small, rusting iron staircase, from which the once white paint was peeling in long, damp strips. And if you went down the staircase and traversed the marshy place at the bottom of the steps and pushed your way through a half-decayed wooden door, you would find yourself in the sub-cellar, a huge room in which 120 years of hospital waste had accumulated, been abandoned, and eventually forgotten. And it was here that Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar had, for the present, made their home. The walls were damp, and water dripped from the ceiling. Odd things mouldered in corners. Some of them had once been alive. Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar were killing time. Mr. Vandemar had obtained from somewhere a centipede, a reddish-orange creature almost 8 inches long with vicious, poisonous fangs, and was letting it run over his hands, watching it as it twined between his fingers, vanished up one sleeve, appeared a minute later out of the other. Mr. Croup was playing with razor blades. He had found a whole box of 50-year-old razor blades, wrapped in glassine paper, in a corner, and had been trying to think of things to do with them. "If I might have your attention, Mr. Vandemar," he said at length, "pipe your beady eyes on this." Mr. Vandemar held the centipede's head delicately between a huge thumb and a massive forefinger to stop it wriggling, and looked at Mr. Croup. Mr. Croup put his left hand against a wall, fingers spread. He took 5 razor blades in his right hand, took careful aim, and threw them at the wall. Each blade stuck into the wall between Mr. Croup's fingers. It was like a top knife thrower's act in miniature. Mr. Croup took his hand away, leaving the blades in the wall outlining the place his fingers had been, and he turned to his partner for approval. Mr. Vandemar was unimpressed. "What's so clever about that, then?" he asked. "You didn't even hit 1 finger." Mr. Croup sighed.
"Ah, I didn't," he said. "Well, slit my gullet, you're right. How could I have been such a ninny?"
He pulled the razor blades out of the wall, one by one, and dropped them onto the wooden table.
"Why don't you show me how it should have been done?"
Mr. Vandemar nodded. He put his centipede back into its empty marmalade jar. Then he put his left hand against the wall. He raised his right arm. His knife, wicked and sharp and perfectly weighted, was in his right hand. He narrowed his eyes and he threw. The knife flew through the air like an extremely large and sharp knife flying through the air very fast indeed. It thudded into the damp plaster wall, blade first, the blade having first hit and penetrated the back of Mr. Vandermeer's hand on its way. A telephone began to ring. Mr. Vandermeer looked around, satisfied, with the knife still through his hand. "That's how it's done," he said. There was an old telephone in the corner of the room. An antique, two-part telephone, unused in the hospital since the 1920s, made of wood and bakelite. Mr. Krupp picked up the earpiece, which was on a long cloth-wrapped cord, and spoke into the mouthpiece, which was attached to the base. "Krupp and Vandermeer," he said smoothly. "The old firm. Obstacles obliterated, nuisances eradicated, bothersome limbs removed, and tutelary dentistry." The person at the other end of the phone said something. Mr. Krupp cringed. Mr. Vandermeer tugged at his left hand. It was pinned hard to the wall and wasn't coming free.
"Oh, yes, sir, yes, indeed. And might I say how your telephonic confabulation brightens up and cheers our otherwise dreary and uneventful day?"
Another pause.
"Of course I'll stop toadying and crawling. Delighted to. An honour. And
what do we know? Well, we know that..." An interruption. He picked his nose reflectively, patiently. Then...
"No, we don't know where she is at this precise moment. But we don't have to. She'll be at the market tonight and..."
His mouth tightened and...
"We have no intention of violating their market truce. More of waiting till she has left the market and scrobbling her."
He was silent then and listened, nodding from time to time. Mr. Vandermeer tried to pull the knife out of the wall with his free hand, but the knife was stuck quite fast.
"That might be arranged, yes," said Mr. Krupp into the mouthpiece. "I mean, it will be arranged, of course. Yes, I realise that. And, sir, perhaps we could talk about..."
But the caller had hung up. Mr. Krupp stared at the earpiece for a moment, then put it back on its hook.
"You think you're so damn clever," he whispered.
Then he noticed Mr. Vandermeer's predicament and said, "Stop that." He leaned over and pulled the knife out of the wall and out of the back of Mr. Vandermeer's hand and put it down on the table. Mr. Vandermeer shook his left hand and flexed the fingers, then wiped the fragments of damp plaster from his knife blade.
"Who was that?"
"Our employer," said Mr. Krupp. "It seems the other one isn't going to work out. Not old enough. It's going to have to be the door female."
"So we aren't allowed to kill her any more?"
"That, Mr. Vandermeer, would be about the short and the long of it, yes. Now, it seems little Miss Dore has announced that she shall be hiring a bodyguard at the market tonight."
"So?" Mr. Vandermeer spat on the back of his hand, where the knife had gone in, and on the palm of his hand, where the knife had come out. He rubbed at the spit with a massive thumb. The flesh closed, knitted, was whole again. Mr. Krupp picked up his old coat, heavy, black and shiny with age, from the floor. He put it on.
"So, Mr. Vandermeer," he said, "shall we not also hire ourselves a bodyguard?"
Mr. Vandermeer slid his knife back into the holster in his sleeve. He put his coat on as well, pushed his hands deep into the pockets, and was pleasantly surprised to find an almost untouched mouse in one pocket. Good. He was hungry. Then he pondered Mr. Krupp's last statement with the intensity of an anatomist dissecting his one true love. And realizing the flaw in his partner's logic, Mr. Vandermeer said,
"We don't need a bodyguard, Mr. Krupp. We hurt people. We don't get hurt."
Mr. Krupp turned out the lights.
"Oh, Mr. Vandemar," he said, enjoying the sound of the words as he enjoyed the sound of all words. "If you cut us, do we not bleed?"
Mr. Vandemar pondered this for a moment in the dark. Then he said, perfectly accurately, "No."